everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 197. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by the fine folks at Astaro, thanks to them. And we'll be hearing from Astaro's head of support, Alan Toews, in this week's sponsor interview at the end of the show. Quickly, I want to say a shout out to my hosting provider, Virtual Office, who hosts the Risky.biz website. I wrote a story this week called, you know, just a little comment piece called Why We Secretly Love Lulzsec that I, you know, I wrote it over my coffee on Wednesday morning, and it wound up blowing up on Twitter, which was quite funny. And actually, Lulzsec wound up linking to it themselves, and it went on Reddit and pointing, and the website somehow managed to survive the inordinate amount of traffic that came in. So thank you to the Virtual Office guys for hosting that VM and keeping it up and running. In this week's feature interview, we're chatting with Neil Wise of assurance.com.au about RSA's decision to finally admit what we all knew already, that their secure ID tokens have been compromised, comprehensively compromised. RSA is now offering to replace all its tokens. So we'll chat to Neil about whether or not it makes sense for all organisations to actually bother with the replacement and, you know, re-enrolment and all of that that drama. It may not necessarily make sense to bother. We'll chat to him about that a little bit later. But before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, it's been a pretty bad news week for a lot of organisations. The latest to fall prey to those pesky hacksaws out there is Citigroup in the United States, which has apparently experienced a pretty significant breach.
Yeah, so the Citigroup is reporting that hackers breached the bank's network, and they're saying something like, 1% of its 21 million customers had data stolen before they apparently stopped it, or they said they discovered it during routine monitoring. So I guess 1% of their customer base is still pretty big, no matter how you find it.
Yeah, and they are a very large bank. Let's not forget that Citigroup is a one of the behemoths of the banking industry over there. So for them to acknowledge that that many, 1% of 21 million, which is what does that make that? That makes it 210,000 customers affected. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and of course they put in the usual shenanigans of not disclosing what's going on, to nominally protect the customers. But I mean, realistically, I guess they just don't want someone else admitting they got hacked by basic SQL injection in the year 2011, like everybody else.
Yeah, or they recycled a password into some CMS or something.
Yeah.
Lame. In this next piece too, this is an interesting one. We've been hearing a lot. If anything, Lulzsec have really projected this Bitcoin virtual currency into the public consciousness and a little bit into the media. I first heard of it only a couple of weeks ago when Wired.com, I think it was Kevin Paulson, wrote a story about this, like kind of like a website that you access via Tor that takes bitcoins in exchange for like drugs. So you can buy LSD and stuff and have it, mailed to you and pay by Bitcoin, and it's quite untraceable. So this Bitcoin currency is becoming quite popular, and now apparently in the United States, some senators and whatnot have said, we really need to look at shutting this down.
Yeah, it does seem like the Bitcoin in general has reached, some kind of critical mass in terms of gaining public awareness and stuff. And yeah, between the Lulzsec taking donations via Bitcoin on Twitter and that article about the Silk Road drugs market, both of those things together, seem to be pushing it out and making it a bunch more visible. And it's, of course, it's inevitable that we're going to see some attempt at legislative hand-wringing about the Silk Road drug market thing that certainly was inevitable, but it's exactly the sort of challenge that I guess the people who are pushing Bitcoin are interested in seeing what happens with. I mean, it does really start to test exactly how robust the currency is going to be in the face of people actively trying to mess with people using it. Of course, the downside of the publicity it's got lately is that the fluctuation of the Bitcoin currency exchange rates has been nuts. Like, we've seen it go from $7 US a Bitcoin a week ago to 20 something, like $28 a Bitcoin US now. So if you were lucky enough to be sitting on a pile of Bitcoins, you're making some real money even if you're not mining them.
So it's behaving like a genuine volatile commodities market then.
well exactly, yeah.
But it is interesting, and you have to wonder. I mean, we had e-gold as the first sort of instantiation of this type of currency that I was aware of, and that of course got shut down. The thing that makes Bitcoin interesting is it's a distributed sort of peer-to-peer currency system. So you've really got to wonder, even if the US somehow manages, or whatever country somehow manages to crack down on Bitcoin, you're going to think eventually that there's going to be some form of online currency that will be able to sidestep regulation by virtue of the way it's designed. And that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bitcoin is you know, it's the first currency that really has been designed to do exactly that. I mean, say compared with e-gold or some of the other mechanisms, which are a bit sort of a bit more primitive. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin is very much from the beginning designed to resist exactly this kind of you know, nation state level interference.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of the sort of development we saw in peer to peer software after Napster was shut down. It's like people sat down at the drawing board and thought, well, what can we do so that they can't mess with it? You know, and that's how we wound up with BitTorrent. Yay!
Yeah, BitTorrent and, you know, systems like Freenet, which didn't gain as much traction. But yeah, and certainly Tor itself. Of course, the funny thing that, you know, I guess the senators in question may not be aware of is that Tor is a US Navy project, dudes. It's your fault in the first fucking place.
Oh, Sony got owned.
Shock horror.
And we're not going to do the Ponzerize thing anymore. I guess, you know, we're trying to make a point with that, which is that, you know, every week we've been talking about some sort of major breach. So instead of discussing what's been Ponzerized, from now on we're just going to refer to it as another event in the ongoing Ponzocalypse. But Sony, tell us about it.
Yep, so Sony, it's getting kind of difficult to keep track of exactly which bit of Sony's, you know, sprawling empire got owned, you know, in the last, you know, 24 hours or whatever it is.
Well, it's actually funny, attrition.org have set up a page where you can actually track all of the Sonage.
Yeah, so what are we talking about? This is 150K records from Sony Pictures, it was Sony Pictures, wasn't it?
I don't know, man. No, look it up on attrition, you know, because I'm seeing there today the company posted a statement saying that personally identifying information of 37,500 customers had been exposed. And then further on in the same story, they're talking about a portion of the data it could steal, 150,000. Whatever. Sony's been owned. Let's move on.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, here's a little Lulzsec one, which is quite funny. I mean, that was a Lulzsec one, wasn't it, previously?
Yeah, well, Lulzsec was involved in some of the Sony owners, yeah, and they were certainly disputing some of the numbers coming out of Sony.
Well, here's a funny one, which was done by guys calling themselves the Lulzraft. They hacked into Canada's Conservative Party website and put a press release up basically saying that the Prime Minister had been rushed to hospital after choking on his breakfast. Which I guess for some people would have been wishful thinking.
I suppose it's inevitable we're going to see this sort of a sort of copycat thing. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. You know, every O-Day, every time someone gets owned through a bug that's being used for the lulz, is one less bug that, you know, one less owner is just being done by organized crime. So I'm all in favor of the Canadian Prime Minister choking on his hash brown.
Well, and no doubt the Canadian Prime Minister would have been made aware of this issue, and perhaps it might have prompted him to ask a few questions, like, how could someone do that so easily?
Well, exactly, yeah. And this is, you know, the crux of your argument about Lulzsec being a good thing. Like, it does, you know, it's much better this gets used for jokes and lulz than it does for real crime. So, yeah, I think it's good, and hopefully the Prime Minister is asking exactly those questions today after he's finished his breakfast.
Now, there's been a whole bunch in the Ponzocalypse. There's been a whole bunch of individual events happening. I was even hearing on the radio this morning that a whole bunch of Vietnamese and Chinese hackers are going and doing the whole mass defacement thing over some dispute over maritime borders or something. We've got the Pakistan cyber army hacking Acer Europe. We've got
anonymous fax bombing NATO.
Yeah, we've got anonymous fax bombing NATO. We've got a whole bunch of stuff. CNetNews.com has a good roundup.
Yeah, and it certainly has been an interesting week for it, eh? Like, although one of the less covered stories, I guess, that's come out has been this rather strange one about the MI6 allegedly hacking Al-Qaeda's online magazine.
Yeah, that was pretty funny, and they just sort of buggered it up, too. They didn't really try to alter the content or embed it with malware or anything. They just turned it into, you know, they just deleted some pages and hosted, you know, put it back on the hosting.
Yeah, which, you know, I guess is a little bit more subtle than some of the things we've seen. But certainly, you know, if the, you know, MI6 are actually, you know, being outed for carrying out this sort of thing, you know, that's something you would expect to get more media coverage than it has.
Well, fundamentalist websites are an excellent source of O-Day. I mean, HB Gary Federal, we know from looking at their mail that they'd cottoned onto that, which is if you find some sort of Al-Qaeda site and there's, you know, a whole bunch of Word documents there, pull them down and have a look, because chances are they're loaded with ODAI that's been put there by intelligence agencies looking to infiltrate Islamic groups.
Seriously. That's a very good point indeed.
So, yeah, if anyone's out there looking for a bit of ODAI, go hit up the old Al-Qaeda boys.
Dear.
Anyway.
It's a strange world, really, isn't it?
No, it is a strange world. But, I mean, look, really, that's, you know, look for the forums where intelligence agencies would want to be owning the people who read that forums. And that's where you get the client sides these days, man. You hadn't thought of that, had you?
Actually, no, you're right. I totally hadn't thought of that. I know what I'm doing this afternoon. Hunt me some MI6 ODAI.
Moving on, and we've been talking over the last couple of weeks about this MacDefender malware. It's still out there, and the guys behind it are apparently just assigning more and more names to it and popping up more and more variants. Unfortunately, for some companies out there, they're actually adopting the names of legitimate software. So there's one called MacShield, which actually is a legit company. So, you know, it's kind of causing confusion. It's causing drama.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, really, isn't it? They're, you know, picking random names and there are already anti-malware products called that, which that does have to suck a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Although you've got to wonder at the scale of their business model, like the legitimate Mac anti-malware people, given how little Mac malware we've seen so far. You can't imagine they're making a fat ton of cash.
Well, I think F-Secure has just dropped a free version, and Sophos's version of AV for Mac is free. Do you know what I mean? So I think at this stage they're using it as a bit of a chance to gobble up some market share and get people familiar with their products.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, maybe they're just as much of a fan of these, you know, rogue AV guys as we are of LulzSec.
Yeah, maybe. We're not fans of LulzSec, shut up.
No, sorry, no,
we secretly are, like them, remember?
Secretly?
Secretly, yes. Yeah, we do not approve. We are serious business.
We do not endorse the activities of LulzSec or Lulz Boats or...
Or rafts at all. Oh, now I like this story because Hotmail and Yahoo have, sort of joined the little party. You know, I think they've been feeling a bit inferior, feeling a bit jealous that all of these sort of Chinese activists and whatnot were being owned through their Gmail accounts. So they've come out and said, hey, man, you know, sophisticated attackers have been attacking our customers as well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you're not getting enough market share amongst the, you know, activists and, you know, Chinese political rights people, then, yeah, you do feel a little left out. But, yeah, they came out and said that people were getting owned, although it was interesting. Was it the Hotmail one they were saying was as simple as just getting reading the mail? And from there it was able to, like, cross-site request forgery into your settings and set up mail forwarding, which, I mean, that's not something you really want to be that proud of.
No. I mean, it's a pretty boneheaded thing to be able to exploit, isn't it? I mean, you'd think that a code review would have picked that up.
Well, you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And I mean, Hotmail, it's not like Hotmail isn't mature. It's been around for a damn long time. But yes, I guess, you know, it's a case of keeping up with the Googles, making sure that you're getting your users owned just as much.
Yay! Oh, and this is an interesting little piece that popped up via Associated Press. But a whole bunch of sort of Chinese military scholars have basically accused the United States of launching a global internet war against Arab countries and other governments, and have also said that, you know, US agents are owning the shit out of Chinese assets, so that their only response, and this is very funny because, you know, I actually argued this point in the speech that I did in South Africa, you know, the only response that any government has in this environment is to actually escalate their own capability, which is why we're getting this sort of mini arms race. I mean, we always sort of spoke about the metaphorical arms race in security between the bad guys and the good guys, but now it's on a government level and there's lots of R&D going into it. But it's just interesting hearing the Chinese perspective on this, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't seem entirely unreasonable for them to suggest that the US are behind some cyber attacks. And certainly Stuxnet, right, is a great example of one that was, you know, almost certainly going to have been government originated. And, you know, and we've seen a response from Iran, which is, you know, that they're attempting to build their own sort of more segregated, more secure internet of their own, so they can maintain sovereignty, which is exactly what the Chinese scholars were saying as well. This is about protecting, you know, their digital sovereignty, and you know, I guess that's kind of hard to argue with. And you're right, it is turning into an arms race. And I mean, given that, you know, the vast majority of our hardware comes out of, you know, what, Shenzhen or somewhere inside China, we're not going to win.
Well, this article apparently written by these scholars says, of late, an internet tornado has swept across the world, massively impacting and shocking the globe. Behind all this lies the shadow of America. Faced with this warm-up for an internet war, every nation and military can't be passive, but is making preparations to fight the internet war. So that, you know, I find that sort of rhetoric, which is quite interesting. And I'm hoping that if this stuff becomes discussed publicly enough, you know, we might get some sort of global consensus on what is the behavior of a good actor and what is the behavior of a bad actor. And maybe, just maybe, we can turn the dial down on some of this stuff. Because at the moment, if I had to describe succinctly the current state of play, it is that everybody at a government level and an intelligence level is up in everybody else's
Well, exactly. And we as the public, and we in the private sector, InfoSec industry, we have no idea of the scale of the problem because no one wants to talk about it, right? The governments are not going to admit they get owned. Companies aren't going to admit they get owned. Governments aren't going to admit that they're maintaining offensive capability and indeed using it. You know, we can't even get a straight answer out of who wrote Stuxnet. You know, we just have no idea what's going on. And until we are willing to discuss it, you know, more openly, that we're just not going to get anywhere. And, you know, the net result is that our tax dollars are paying for our governments to go and do this shit on nominally on our behalf. We have no idea what's going on. And that's a pretty bad situation.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because every time you drop a bomb on someone, the casings have to be marked with the country of origin. You know,
well, so, yeah, exactly. It's much more attributable as sort of the kinetic.
Yeah, but it's attributable because there's rules that say it has to be. Do you know what I mean? So everyone talks in the sort of cyber realm and says attribution is this massive problem. If you reach a global consensus that says you must attribute your actions, then that's, you know, it's just bringing it in line with current traditional military doctrine, you know? I mean, the United States could very easily drop bombs on people that were unmarked. I don't know, maybe they do, but I don't think it's the norm. Do you know what I mean? There seems to be this generally accepted world rule that says when you engage someone in a military sense, when you engage a country in a military action, they've got to know it's you. So I'm wondering when we're going to actually see some rules around this stuff popping up anyway, but probably not. I don't know. We'll see. It's early days. Who knows where this will be in a few years?
I guess the next Stuxnet will have, you know, two Beijing with love from Alabama written on the side and paint.
That's right. That's right. Put some little comments in the code, but or maybe they'll be forced to digitally sign it. Now, this next story, Adam, I find, you know, borderline upsetting. I think this is a terrible thing for the industry. I think it's a terrible thing for general business out there. There's been a court case in the United States in Maine where a judge ruled that a bank was not responsible for the theft of $300,000 from a customer's account. You know, someone got the customer's username and password. That was all that they were, you know, allowing the customer to use to protect this account. You know, 300 grand gone, vamoosed, and the customer's out of pocket. Now, personally, I think the banks should be forced to pay for that because they're the institutions that are in the best position to actually offer more sophisticated solutions to their customers. Like, you know, something like an RSA Secure. Oh, wait. But you get what I'm saying, right? We've got this instance where Ocean Bank was found not liable. So I think this is kind of a precedent that could be a little bit dangerous, don't you?
Yeah, it was a pretty disturbing read, really, wasn't it? I mean, the story was this, you know, this company Patco got a bunch of money stolen, and the bank managed to stop some of it being transferred, but they lost about 300k, and they sued the bank for not carrying out appropriate, you know, best practice security stuff. And the judge ruled that username and password plus some profiling of the machine that was coming from was adequate two-factor auth, which, you know, I think is a bit of a stretch to start with.
Especially then, when you consider that they got popped via Zeus, which is obviously loaded on the same machine. So,
well, exactly, yeah. Like, clearly not an effective security mechanism. And then the second thing that the judge said was that there was no basic requirement or expectation for the banks to have the, quote, best security, unquote. Like, basically best practice was not something that you would expect a bank to aspire to. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's pretty messed up, too. Not really the sort of outcome we're looking for. And as you say, right, the banks are the only ones who are really in a good position to require customers to have strong security methods. And you can't really expect customers to protect themselves to the level that, you know, we in the industry would want them to. Like, it's just not realistic.
No,
the banks are the only people who can either force their customers to, you know, use more security methods, or provide it as an upsell, right? I mean, give them the option to upgrade to RSA and some other token and say, you know, if you do this, then your liability, you know, threshold is raised or something, right? I mean, there's opportunities there to market.
Yeah, but I mean, plenty of banks are doing that already, you know. I know the show is much more fun when you and I disagree about and we get to argue, but I couldn't have said it better, mate. I think we're in complete and total, utter agreement with this. And if we see further decisions or if we see this turning into a precedent, you know, it might get to the stage where there's some lobbying done and lawmakers actually have to step in and set some guidance on this sort of thing, because it just looks like a shitty decision, doesn't it?
It does. I agree. It smells like
okay. Oh, now, here's an interesting little story that popped up. I think it was The Guardian or something. I don't know who covered it originally, but it wound up being republished by a whole bunch of outlets. It was this report that said 25% of US hackers are FBI informants.
Yeah. Like, seriously, what a complete crock of horse shit.
It was, man. And the original article only quoted one guy from like 2600 who just said, yeah, man, there's feds everywhere. It's like, wow, like, way to stick to your, you know, completely scientific journalism, dude.
Yeah, what a shit story.
Yeah, so that was a big bucket of fail. And we're only mentioning it because it's bull.
Totally. Although, hang on a second, how many hackers have you got on the show this week? Right, there's me and there's Neil, and I guess you count, so that's three. So
I don't count. I couldn't hack my way out of a paper bag, Adam, you know that.
Maybe you're the informant then.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, all I'm good for is snitching. Here we go. Here's a bread and butter piece. Adobe has actually fixed a flash issue. Drink! But it looks like, you know, it looks like the way this bug was being exploited, because it was actually being exploited in the wild. Oh, way to go, Adobe. You know, this week again. But it looks like it was being exploited in quite an interesting and clever way.
Yeah, so this is, it's not your average run-of-the-mill flash bug in the sense that it's not memory corruption leading the code execution. It's a, they called it what, a universal cross-site scripting vuln. So basically you can get the flash, you know, you can inject code into the flash application such that it will make requests on behalf of the attacker using the credentials of the authenticated legitimate user. And then this was being used to backdoor people's Gmail accounts by virtue of setting up mail forwarding and stuff, which is quite an interesting use of it, and a good example of a slightly different flash bug. Although we still get to drink, I guess that's all right.
You got to wonder how many flash bugs are currently being exploited in the wild. You know, what do you reckon? 2 dozen, 3 dozen, 100, 200?
Certainly a bunch. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I guess on the scale, but I mean, you know, if we had to drink for every flash bug that came out, we would probably be in a coma.
Yes, I would agree with that. We would have very sore livers. Here we go in this next story, which sounds basically the death knell for privacy in the digital age. Facebook has by default enabled facial recognition on accounts that basically suggest to your friends, you know, you take a photo of me, you put it in your Facebook thing and it goes, that looks like Patrick Gray. Is that correct? And you can just go, yep. So they're trying to basically auto tag all of these photos. And when you think about, I mean, you and I both know, you know, some of the guys who work in some interesting organizations, right? And you think of some of the intelligence applications for this automated social network matching and analysis, and it's pretty freaking scary.
It certainly is. And this kind of tech, it's genuinely scary. And, you know, you've got to wonder, you know, whether, you know, Facebook is taking funding from, you know, from organizations, you know, from spooky organizations to do exactly this. Because it really does seem like a wet dream for, you know, for the FBI, the CIA, NSA, anyone who, you know, wants to track, you know, social networks and interactions between people.
Well, the photos are public anyway, man. So who's, you know, of course they're bloody doing this already, and they wouldn't even need Facebook's cooperation beyond getting access to some sort of basic API, which would feed them publicly available data anyway. I mean, all of your photos, I mean, as we were shown at a recent B-Sides presentation in Queensland, you know, all of these photos have public links. Okay, even ones in private albums. So that would mean that it would not be a legal problem whatsoever for Facebook to provide law enforcement with access to an API that would enable them to go through those photos and apply that technology.
Agree, but the important point is here is that one, we have some facial recognition technology which has a given failure rate or whatever. The important thing here is that you're getting it confirmed by people. Right, yeah. You're outsourcing this metadata tagging to a bunch of people who are able to make better decisions in your code. You can use that to train your facial recognition code to be able to do a better job itself, but you're also getting, you know, much higher quality data than you would programmatically straight out of the box. Like, that's the important thing here, and that's Facebook has got, you know, 500 million users or whatever it is, and you're leveraging 500 million people's worth of compute power to start metadata tagging your images. Right, that's the real value here.
A friend of ours actually showed me recently a thing online called, it's called the Predator, like tracking system, video tracking system. It's a really creepy little YouTube clip. This guy's basically come up with a really nice little algo for tracking stuff in video, which adjusts based on the movement of the object. So it'll track like this panda walking around its enclosure, and it will basically model the whole thing and learn what it looks like from every angle. Now, once you start meshing all this stuff in, CCTV everywhere, it's just, I don't know, man, it's... You know, I've been kind of on the side of saying people are getting a little bit too panicked about this sort of stuff, but when I see stuff like this, I just get alarmed. It's alarming.
It is pretty f***ing creepy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it really is. And I think the funniest thing I saw, look, I don't personally think there is any sort of financial involvement from the intel agencies in something like Facebook, but I don't think there needs to be, because the idea of Facebook is to take all of your information and make it public anyway. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's for, as far as any intelligence agency is concerned, this is a giant OSINT project. This is open source intelligence.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just creepy, deaky, weirdy stuff. And I don't like it very much.
No, me either. It does, you know, kind of set the creepy sense off. Eh? It makes your spine tingle a bit. That's what I say to Facebook. Do not want.
All right, mate. Well, on that extremely depressing, sad note, that's it for this week's news, mate. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, hopefully the world hasn't ended by then.
Hey.
If it hasn't, I will talk to you then.
Adam Bylow there with a look at the week's news headlines. As you are no doubt aware, RSA Security admitted back in March that its network got popped and some valuable IP stolen that could have been used against certain secure ID customers in certain circumstances. Frustratingly, though, the company didn't provide comprehensive details on what was actually stolen. Ludicrously, the company recently stated that RSA withheld details of what was stolen so they wouldn't give the attackers ideas on how the stolen data could be used in an attack. Now, I'm sorry to break it to you, RSA, but I'm guessing that the attackers knew what the data could be used for, and that's why they took it in the first place. Well, RSA has come clean now and now admits that important data pertaining to its secure ID tokens has been pinched, and if you really want to guarantee that they can't be cloned, you'll need to replace them. But should you bother, how useful are tokens in the first place these days in 2011? Joining me now to discuss all things secure ID is Neil Wise of assurance.com.au.
You know, I know that they had to work out what went wrong, but, you know, they started off by, you know, saying basically that the compromise, you know, didn't lead to a direct attack, but it does decrease the effectiveness of secure ID. It's like, that just seems now like the understatement of the year, you know?
So we would say then that the horses bolted on secure ID and really all of the existing tokens, we can just assume that if an attacker has access to the data they stole from RSA and they can somehow socially engineer or fish the PIN from a user, then that token is no good as a second factor. I mean, that's the assumption now, right?
I guess it is, but other than the seed, you know, or whatever happens behind the scenes in creating the tokens part of it, that's issue, I guess, has existed with these kind of controls anyway, that, you know, if users don't keep the confidential part of that data to themselves, they give it up, then, you know, this is going to happen. But I guess the fact that what I think hurts the most with this is that the organizations who have this technology, you know, invested in it to avoid exactly this sort of situation occurring. So you'd think that the company who was providing that strong control for them would have better practices towards protecting their own confidential information in doing this. If that data is taken, like in my mind, it's the equivalent of somebody attacking one of, you know, the certificate authorities and somehow stealing the offline root cert, you know, for like some major, you know, SSL certificate, like, which just shouldn't happen because by practice it's offline. So I'm just astounded that this could happen this way, and the fact that hearing announcements like, okay, RSA just appointed a CSO yesterday, you know, and it's really?
So, well, that was Eddie Schwartz, actually, who was the former CSO of NetWitness.
NetWitness. But it just seems like a company with the history and track record that RSA has, as far as what they are and who their customers are, that, I mean, obviously they have, you know, very formal security things that would have been going on, but someone responsible for the organization's own security, you'd think would be kind of a more of a I guess with something that I would think would be in their corporate structure, they would have, you know, such a thing.
Now, we know that RSA has initiated something of a recall, more that they're offering to replace tokens. But the question is, should everyone necessarily bother with that? I've seen some news that ANZ Bank is replacing tokens for all of its customers. Now, I'm thinking the people who stole that information from RSA and used it to attack Lockheed Martin, they're probably not that interested in Bob and Mavis's joint bank account. So I'm kind of wondering why, you know, when we haven't seen any evidence of this sort of informational technique being used to exploit bank customers and things like that, I'm wondering why ANZ is actually running out there and doing a replacement. Do you think these tokens should be replaced under all circumstances, or do you think that they should only be replaced in high security environments?
I think the responsible thing for me to say to that is I don't know, and I don't think they do either. But I think that the organizations like ANZ who are doing that, I think Westpac has also announced that they're going to replace tokens as well. These organizations they're showing their due care and responsibility to their customers, which, to be honest, is more than I can say for RSA, for the time that they spent in, I guess, investigating this issue, but in downplaying its impact, only for that to, you know, apparently not be the case.
Well, they actually also said, Neil, that the reason they didn't come out and say, you know, give more details about what was compromised is they didn't want to give the attackers ideas. Now, that was ridiculous logic to me, because really the people who took that data knew what they were taking and they knew what they could use it for.
Oh, I think that's something that seems like it would be apparent, like with us, with what seems to be like whether the Lockheed Martin attack definitely was or wasn't connected to that, whether these other things, like, I mean, the first thing that screams to me does say sort of nation state stuff going on for using this data. So I really doubt that it is people who are going to target banking. But that's not to say that someone else, I mean, like, you know, there's always reuse. So
well, that's
always,
I mean, it might leak eventually, right?
Oh, it obviously will. So it's something that I think it's a good bit of security theater. Like, to be honest, because I think until that's determined that the technology, and maybe it has been, and I just, you know, we're just not aware of it, until we can determine that the technology hasn't been the contributing factor to, you know, to what's happened, replacing it with the same technology is a lot of, I guess, going. And I think that even seeing stuff like banks saying that they'll continue replacing tokens just to keep their clients from worrying about whether this attack has any, you know, would have compromised their tokens.
Yeah, look, it really does seem like a perception management thing for me. I mean, that's why I was kind of asking you about why these banks, you know, I mean, they're not, these Chinese super hackers are after the, you know, Lockheed Martin's super duper laser beam, right? They're after the Lasermatron flesh melter 20,000. They don't give a shit about Bob and Mavis's joint bank account.
Bob and Mavis are going to buy a Fleshmatron.
Flesher-melter-tron. Yeah. It's the latest top secret project. I think I hear the black helicopters pulling up now because the word is out. But yeah, I'm sure you take my point that it does look like security theater. I do agree with you. The other point that I wanted to raise with you and to see if you agree with this is, I reckon to a large degree, especially considering some of the more advanced malware out there like Zeus, it seems to me that tokens have kind of reached their use-by date anyway. What good are these bloody things anyway?
Well, I think it's more when they're combined with appropriate practices and other controls that are from other technologies. So some of the recommendations people have been making is, you know, incorporating, in addition to your token and PIN, you know, incorporating like a username and password authentication or using certificates or something like that. And when I read advice like that, it just makes me wonder, like, who designed your two-factor solution in the first place?
That's not a two-factor solution, dude. That's a one-factor solution.
Well, and anything, like, I'm going to tell you, like, anything that is an internet accessible function that's directly integrated with an internal authentication source is always going to be a recipe for a disaster at some point. Mm-hmm. So lining a couple of those up, or you know, something like that would help. But I guess the thing I've really wondered in all this is that the due care and responsibility that RSA has to its customers, like whether or not they were trying to avoid giving hackers ideas or whatever else they were doing, they weren't, you know, necessarily communicating quickly with their customer as they were saying. And I actually just have to wonder if any of it was just in order to avoid well, raising alarm, but also too, like as an organization, what happens with liability with this? You know, who's, you know, is if RSA technology is found to be a contributing factor to any of these large high profile attacks, does RSA, are they liable in some way?
Well, I guess that would depend on whether or not they're negligent, but I'm not a lawyer and neither are you, so we'll let them worry about that. But, you know, either way, I don't think RSA has won too many friends in the security industry. But, you know, okay, we know that they were running shitty OPSEC, right? We know that they got owned. We know that their technology, you know, they weren't storing seed files by the look of things in
an HSM offline.
Exactly, right? You know, in a sensible manner. But why do we for a second think that, like, Vasco are doing anything more sensibly than RSA? I mean, that's the point, right? Is we can point to RSA and we can say, you guys are a bad actor. But really, what makes us think anyone's doing anything better?
I definitely agree that this is a teaching moment for the other vendors of technology like this, that if they haven't, you know, obviously reviewed their OPSEC like functions and how that all that operates in the organization, I'm sure they have by now, that it's just something that I think that it is probably, you're going to find that it is similar practices in lots of different organizations. And, you know, there's just sometimes that, you know, certain types of targeted attacks too, you just may not be able to defend against them. You know, like it could be, there could be insider threats.
It's an interesting year, 2011. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree. We live in interesting times. So.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We do. Yeah. And so, Neil, any final word of advice out there for people who are considering? I mean, I know we've discussed the idea that perhaps replacing these tokens in some situations is actually a bit of security theater. I would understand why ANZ would want to replace tokens that are being used by its staff on its internal network, because I can imagine that, you know, an organization that controls 20% or so of Australia's retail banking would be of interest to a foreign state. But why they're protecting Bob and Mavis's joint, you know, marital account, I don't quite understand. What would your advice be? I mean, do you think people need to buy into the security theater for out of reputation management, or do you think perhaps some of them should just let it slide because there's not really going to be a lot of risk when it comes to their customers getting popped?
Well, I think that for the organizations like ANZ and Westpac who provide secure ID functions, like it's mostly for business services and it's primarily used for, you know, high value transfers, and you can, it's something you just pay for, so it's an additional service you pay for every month. I think that part of the motivation for replacing it may be, you know, well, being responsible to their customers. Part of it may be just trying to do what RSA has said would be an appropriate way to mitigate, you know, the exposure and to try to avoid unauthorized transfers from occurring, because I think that's, you know, could be potential fraud, you know.
And they also transfer the banks. When you're using these token-enabled accounts, the banks actually agree to own a lot more of the liability, don't they? So that kind of would explain why it would be a bit of a driver and stick out on ye olde risk register.
But I think they should do it mainly just because I'm one of those people who, like, I'm a big fan of free thing. So, you know, it's like you go to a conference and someone's giving away pens and hats. Like, I don't really wear hats, but I'll take their hat.
Yeah, get a backpack, man, and just fill that shit up.
yeah. So I think that if your organization, your bank, whoever offers a token, you should certainly take it. If they don't, you should hassle them until they do. As far as whether it's a good practice as what they're doing in swapping those things out, to be honest, like, I think I would be casting a bit of a wider net, and I'm looking at whether or not I should be looking at either different technologies in general or one of the other specific offerings in this space. Just because you've already been burned by one. At the same time, too, I would imagine that there's going to be a renewed focus on this area for RSA, obviously. So I think that long term, I don't know whether you'd be more or less inclined to get done by sticking with them or moving. But
but we don't. I mean, that's the thing. We don't know. We don't know if Vasco has been owned. They could be owned right now.
Yep. And I think that this is where that other soft token type implementations that are device based or things like that, this may just accelerate their rate of adoption and consideration for these kind of functions.
I don't trust those things, man, especially because they're running on all these bloody insecure mobile OSs. It's just, you
know, network connected and jailbroken.
It's like jumping straight out of the pan into the fire. Hooray. You know, let's just accelerate the Ponzocalypse, you know. Here it goes. All right, Neil Wise, thank you so much for joining us to have a little bit of a discussion about RSA. I can tell you're not a massive fan of their behavior of late. Pleasure to speak to you, mate, and we will speak to you soon.
Yeah, great. Talk to you soon.
Neil Wise of assurance.com.au there. And Neil and the guys run a pretty tidy little pen testing shop down there in Melbourne, just so you know. Definitely worth checking them out. And Assurance is pretty much the number one wireless security shop in the country too. So, I don't know, chuck them in your Rolodex or something. Okay, up next, it's time for our sponsor interview. Risky Business only exists through the generous support of its sponsors. And this week's sponsor is Astaro, makers of fine border security and UTM devices. So fine, in fact, that the entire company was recently acquired by Sophos. So there you go. And joining me this week is Astaro's Director of Support, Alan Toews. And we're chatting about the silver lining to the whole Lulzsec campaign of mayhem. Could the positive impact of the awareness they're raising through all of their shenanigans actually outweigh the negative impact of all of the damage they're doing? Who do we blame for this fine InfoSec mess? Also, this is something that Alan and I wound up speaking about. Do we blame the vendors who make crappy products or the customers who misconfigure them? Here's Alan Toews.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've got their own points they want to push. I mean, I don't know what their beef is with Sony particularly, but certainly Sony's, you know, not won a lot of love in the general internet community in the last few years. But ultimately, I think it does highlight the need for security, and, you know, like it or not, it does ultimately focus on a good topic. It's helping us to see why, you know, what we need in the industry, why we need better security, more comprehensive security, and just how vulnerable systems we may not have thought vulnerable are.
Well, I think also the point is that even systems that where effort has gone into securing them are quite vulnerable. I mean, that's really what I've interpreted their point to be. And I just wonder as a vendor, I mean, how that makes you feel. Because on one hand, you know, you'll have sections of, you know, the pro Lulzsec crew pointing at the vendors and saying, well, it's your fault because you're not making the products that are required to secure stuff. And then again, from the vendor's point of view, they're saying, well, you know, maybe, but the customers out there aren't actually asking for stuff that would actually give them meaningful security because they don't want to pay for it. I mean, is it a little in column A, a little in column B?
You know, absolutely. When you're dealing with customers, you really cross the range on what customers know and are willing to do. It's not uncommon at all to come across customers that just don't have a grasp on what security is or what they should be doing to secure a network. And you can give advice, but really, as the vendor, you're not often in the position to be the authoritative voice of what they should be doing. They need a little more in-depth consulting, maybe from somebody who works directly on site with them, doing a more comprehensive overall network picture. So we only get these small windows of what's going on in the network. You know, it's a difficult place because there's always nervousness that maybe, you know, something's going to be missed or something's going to be misconfigured. As a vendor, you know, we really try to fit the needs of our customers and steer them the right way. But, you know, there's things they want to do that are a luxury or they consider a luxury because it's not in their budget. But, you know, it's up to the customer ultimately to use the tool correctly. And that is a frustrating thing because we, you know, you come across customers that put products in, they configure it or they try to configure it and they don't seek advice in a timely manner. Then something bad happens. And when they are asked why, well, it was the vendor's fault. You know, their product let me down.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've heard of executives after some pretty high profile breaches being quite surprised that their systems were compromised because they were spending so much money on antivirus.
Yeah, you know, no one tool does it. I mean, that's what we're seeing more and more. I mean, there's a big push in the industry these days for the buzzword is next generation firewall. I mean, that's a new tool that everybody has, and that's the new cure-all for everything. But it doesn't replace anything that's come before it. It's just a new way to secure the holes that you did have to open previously. So if you're opening port 80 for web traffic, it's another way to look at that web traffic you're letting through and provide additional security. Those are all good things, and they do move the level of security forward, the bar of what can be offered forward. But, you know, there's still so many holes and so many things out there. I mean, if you look at web application security, if a web application vendor's product securing their own website can be misconfigured, which happened recently, and I won't name names, then that really says something to the complexity of the products that are out there and just how hard they are to use correctly.
Now, we started off talking about Lulzsec. What is it that you hope comes of this? What is it that you hope, what is the silver lining that you see to this group of guys going out there just owning up everyone? Do you see that there could be some positive influence?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, anything I think that that shows a vulnerability or alerts people to the necessity for security and makes them take ownership of that responsibility is a good thing in the end. I mean, at least it's a good result to come out of it. I mean, there's certainly some prices to pay along the way, it seems, for particularly for a few companies like Sony, who are just getting, they're definitely getting some very specific and bad attention out of this whole deal. Who's to say what would happen if that attention got pointed at Microsoft or at Nintendo or anybody else for that matter who's operating, whose networks may or may not be similarly vulnerable?
Well, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It's not, do we really think that any other similar network isn't just as vulnerable?
We have to think it is. I mean, I think anybody looking at this has to look at this and say a company like Sony isn't ignorant of security. At least, you know, there's people there that are aware of what security is and what needs to be done. And they must have taken some steps and spent money to make their network secure. You know, having never worked at Sony or with Sony or known anybody who actually worked in their security divisions, I have no insight into what they've done, but you know, I have to believe that they've taken similar standards to most every other company in the country. So how can we not believe, with thinking of it like that there isn't similar vulnerabilities waiting to happen in many other similar companies?
So I mean, then what becomes the take-home message? I think the take-home message becomes that we're all vulnerable, and I think that's a message that does need to be out there, so that perhaps the quality of the software that's being used out there can be improved, the quality of the security kit used to mitigate the vulnerabilities is improved, and perhaps we start rethinking what we actually use computers to do.
Yeah, I mean, those are all excellent points. And you know what, if network admins are going back and thinking about their security, if not just network admins, but the accountants at companies, the marketing people at companies, the CEOs and CFOs are looking at what they do on a daily basis and seeing how this is affecting a company like Sony and seeing their bottom line being affected by this. And they realize that their actions can contribute to that too. Security is not just a network level thing. It's something that we all have to do. It's everybody's responsibility.
All right, Alan Toews, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
All right, and thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to join you.
Alan Toews on the line there from Astaro. Thank you to Alan for his perspectives this week, and thank you to Astaro. And that is it for this week's show. I'm playing you guys out now with a song by The Basics. You can get this one on iTunes. It is called With This Ship, and I love this song, I gotta say. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening to our rolling coverage of the Ponzocalypse. Try to send a message, but you don't